The NFL draft is coming up this week, and there's a good deal of attention focused on the uncertain prospects of former University of Florida quarterback Tim Tebow. Commentator Frank DeFord is paying attention.
Come up here, please, to the presidential suite and give a big NPR welcome to Tim Tebow, proclaimed by many as the greatest college football player ever and now ready for the NFL draft. Heisman Trophy winner, the hero who steered Florida to two national championships, bright, strong, a natural leader. Now, if you'll come downstairs here in that bunch of wannabes crowded over by the Murphy bed, give a nod to Tim Tebow, the quarterback with the strange throwing motion, religious fundamentalist, lightning rod misfit, and obvious classic example of the Peter Principle pro football version. Yes, the intrigue in the NFL draft, which begins tomorrow evening and lasts longer than your average Icelandic volcanic eruption, this year centers not on the top of the draft, but on Tebow, who will almost surely not be drafted anywhere in the first round and who knows, might not even be drafted at all. It's like having a presidential election with most of the attention going to a congressional race in Montana. Everybody is an expert on Tebow, and the expert consensus is that he is a collegiate hybrid who will be exposed in the big time. The quarterback, born sickly in the Philippines to missionaries, is one of those people who is not himself controversial, but who just always seems to get caught up in the middle of stuff. Even back in high school, when he was educated at home, he was one of the more publicized cases in the dispute about whether homeschool students should be allowed to play on public school teams. When concussions became big news, he got a big concussion. When he starred in a pro-life commercial with his mother, otherwise sensible adversaries wanted to temporarily void the First Amendment to prevent the commercials airing during the Super Bowl. Tebow's coach, Urban Meyer, a man who has admitted the pressure might be getting to him, proved that recently by publicly upbraiding a sports writer for correctly quoting a teammate who had dared say that, by comparison, Tebow might not be a real quarterback. That, you see, is the crux of the issue. Sure, Tim Tebow may be the greatest college player ever, but he just doesn't do things the approved NFL way. What team has the guts to draft him? An answer to the nerds who measure football talents, as phrenologists used to measure character by the shape of the skull. Me, I'm certainly no football scout, but I rather like players who win. I wouldn't mind having Tim Tebow on the bench when the starting quarterback gets hurt and he has to go in and begin calling plays and doing things his way. Yeah, I think I like my chances with Tim Tebow.
Commentator Frank DeFord does things his way each week for member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. You know, before doing interviews like this next one, I'm frequently having to blow my nose. Some of my colleagues have red noses, watery eyes. The pollen count across the United States is at its highest in years. We're going to find out why and what the remedies might be for allergy sufferers from Dr. Philip Gallagher, who is an allergist in northwestern Pennsylvania. Dr. Gallagher, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And I understand you're somebody who really knows the pollen count.
I am. I've been counting pollen in Erie since 1989.
Meaning that you step outside and, well, how do you count pollen anyway?
I have a sampler on my roof, and every morning I climb up on the roof and retrieve the sample and stain it in my kitchen and take it into my office and count it on a microscope.
So how's the pollen count in Erie?
It's been pretty high. It came in early this year. We had a really big increase in the pollen count, which we normally don't see. And then over the past few days, it's been a little lower because there's been frost on the roof.
Frost on the roof?
Yeah.
Does that help a little bit?
No, yeah. Trees don't pollinate when the temperature is below 40 degrees in the morning. So if you get frosty mornings, then the counts are down.
I have to tell you, this is one of the reasons that the high pollen count surprised me because, as you know very well, there were massive, devastating snowstorms, at least in the eastern United States and much of the rest of the United States as well, over the winter. And I thought a harsh winter would kind of beat down the pollen count a little later in the spring, slow down nature a little bit.
Well, pollen's a local problem. So, for example, the cedar pollen is a major problem in Oklahoma, and I met the counter from Oklahoma in early March, and she was telling me that the trees hadn't pollinated there because it had been cold in Oklahoma, and they were waiting for the cedar trees to pollinate.
Well, now, I suppose as a pollen counter, you must be able to give very precise advice to the allergy sufferers. Do you ever have patients coming in with horrible allergies and you tell them they should move?
No.
So what do you tell them?
Basically, there are three ways to treat allergy. One is by avoidance, the second is with medication, and the third is with injections. So with pollen, it's very difficult to avoid pollen. You can keep your windows shut, and if you have to, run your air conditioning. If you're spending time outdoors, you can rinse your nose with a little saline when you come in and take a shower. If there are tasks outside that seem to bother you, you can try wearing a mask to see if that will help, because the pollens are relatively large particles, and so usually mechanical masks will hold them back. It's just a regular, you know, dust mask that you might find at a hardware store.
So you walk around looking like a surgeon.
Right. Some people do that, and that can help some, but then there are medications, and the medications today are much better than they were when I first started in practice, and certainly the prescription nasal sprays that anybody's primary care physician can prescribe help a vast majority of people. However, there, as you suggested, there are a number of people who don't respond, and for them, immunotherapy injections are an option.
Now, is that where you get injected with actually little bits of what you're supposedly allergic to and build up an immunity to it?
That's correct. So that really represents a more durable solution to the problem than medication. So medication, if it works well, is just covering up the symptoms, whereas the injections actually increase your tolerance to the things with which you're injected.
Is there any great difference in the effectiveness of prescription versus over-the-counter allergy medications?
Well, over-the-counter, there are basically antihistamines available. And antihistamines are helpful for people who have relatively mild allergies. Basically, the advantage of the prescription medications is there are intranasal steroids and other antihistamine nasal sprays that really work better for people with more persistent or moderate symptoms, and those are available only by prescription.
So will you be measuring the pollen count all summer long?
All summer long. As a matter of fact, I'd be counting right now if I weren't talking to you. So I've got to go and count after I'm done here.
Well, Dr. Gallagher, I'll let you go do some counting.
Okay.
Good luck.
Yep, thanks.
Dr. Philip Gallagher joined us from Erie, Pennsylvania. This week on Morning Edition, we've been talking about the impact of sex abuse scandals on the Catholic Church. We've heard about how the scandals may shape Pope Benedict's legacy. We've heard the story of how Benedict punished a powerful priest when nobody else would. Today, speaking in St. Peter's Square, the Pope said the Church would take action to confront the scandal. Now, the Church's response to all this is of intense interest to E.J. Dionne. He's a columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow with the Brookings Institution, regular guest on our program, All Things Considered, and he's Catholic. I want to start on kind of a personal note, if I might. What has it been like in your church the last few weeks?
Well, our pastor gave a very powerful sermon on Easter about the scandal, and he said a lot of things that needed to be said, not only about individual culpability, but also about institutional culpability. And I think the
church— Did he say we, the church, are guilty?
Yes, he did, but he also was at the end a little bit defensive, talking about enemies of the church, and he sort of defended Pope Benedict. And I happen to love our pastor. He's a wonderful man. My sense is he would have been more effective just sort of saying the mea culpa. You know, I think that the nuns used to tell us that there's nothing like a good confession. And I think that the church's problem here is that they haven't found it easy, to put it charitably, to talk about the institutional problem, to say that, yes, there were moments when we put the institutional interest above other interests.
Pope Benedict himself has actually addressed this crisis, and he has an interesting way of phrasing it here. He says, and this is a quote, "Now under attack from the world which talks to us of our sins, we can see that being able to do penance is a grace, and we see how necessary it is to do penance and thus recognize what is wrong in our lives." Even there you have an acknowledgement of wrongdoing and a discussion of penance, but also describing himself as under attack.
I suppose if I had been an editor, I would have asked him, can you drop the first half? Because I think that part of the problem is that attacking the world first for bringing this to the church's attention undercuts the contrition in the second half. That is a very good statement that the church should make and needs to make, I think, more strongly about itself as an institution. But I think this is a case where the church could actually learn something from the modern world in terms of accepting that the rage out there doesn't just come from enemies of the church. I think it doesn't even come primarily from enemies of the church. There are a lot of us out there who have lived our lives feeling great gratitude to the church. I feel great gratitude to nuns and priests who've been very important in my life. And the sense of disappointment and anger among people who are part of the church, who are in the church, who are not enemies of the church, who don't carry around resentments of the church, those are the folks they need to talk to. And I think that when they talk about outside enemies, they're not talking to those people in the pews.
Is rage a fair word for what you felt from time to time?
Yeah, I have gone back and forth. I found it a very difficult period because, as I say, I feel gratitude toward the church. Early in the scandal, I wrote a column that began with the words, "Some of my best friends are priests." And I wrote it because it was true. And I wrote it because, the church and a lot of individuals in it have been very important to me, to the way I think, to the way I approach the world. The whole idea, God is love and he who abides in love abides in God and God in him. That's a really hopeful orientation toward life, and it's affected, you know, a lot of things deep inside me that I'm not even aware of. And yet when you saw this, when you saw not only that people could do this to children, but also the tendency of the church to kind of push it aside, cover it up in those years, you know, back in the 80s and before, it was at best disappointing, and at worst you asked, how could they do this?
I wonder if it's especially hard for Catholics as opposed to people in other religions or other denominations of Christianity. If you are a Muslim, the imam is important, but he's not your conduit to God necessarily. And if you're in certain branches of Christianity, the pastor has different levels of importance. But with Catholicism, the Pope takes a paramount position.
The paradoxical thing about the Catholic Church is that it is structurally extremely centralized, but in actual practice, it's very decentralized. And I think lots of people stay with the church because they are part of the larger community and a larger tradition, but they are also part of smaller communities, particular parishes, particular priests and nuns, particular prayer groups. And so I think a lot of times when the institutional structure of the church fails them, or they believe it has failed them, they turn back on this group of people who grew out of the tradition and say, this is what the tradition is about. I have a very dear mother-in-law who is a very, very serious, wonderful Catholic, and who is as frustrated as anyone with these things. But she sort of can turn back to her inner faith as a personal matter and to the community of people she has been part of for a very long time and say, that's what the church is really about.
So you have to separate your faith from the guys in the robes, basically.
Right. Well, and I think that's good Catholic doctrine. I mean, that the structure of the church is a human creation. The church teaches it's divinely inspired. You know, thou art Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. But history tells us that there has been corruption in the church at various moments in history. Indeed, the celibate priesthood, priests weren't always celibate. It was instituted as a barrier against corruption, passing on property to kids. So the church has dealt with corruption for a long time. Someone told me a story recently of a bishop or archbishop confronting a dictator who was persecuting the church. And according to this story, he looked at the dictator and said, look, we have done our best to destroy the church, and we have failed. What makes you think you will succeed?
Well, maybe that leads to the final question, then. Do you think that this is just one more scandal, and any institution will have scandals, or that all these years of scandals add up to an earthquake that is in some way going to change the Catholic Church?
Well, I hope it does change the Catholic Church. I would like the church to revisit the issue of an all-male celibate priesthood. I don't expect that to happen soon, and it won't be a cure-all for this, but I'd like at least to see an open debate about that. But more to the point, I think a lot of the solutions to this lie in the church's own preaching. I think when they did the wrong thing, they were really operating on the imperatives of this world, listening to lawyers, listening to PR specialists,
acting like any institution. Yeah.
Whereas behaving like Christians says, yes, we failed. Yes, failure is something that happens to humans a lot. And we are genuinely committed to, as the church likes to say, a firm purpose of amendment. And so I hope that that can happen. And I think somehow it will, but sometimes things take a long time in the Roman Catholic Church.
E.J. Dionne is a columnist for The Washington Post and a regular guest with David Brooks on our own All Things Considered. Good to see you.
It's good to see you.